Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. On this day, 149 years ago, Abraham Lincoln was shot and died of his wounds on April 15. Our guest this hour is doing his part and then some to keep Lincoln's words and poetry alive. He calls Lincoln perhaps our greatest president, and we're drawn to a magical speech that seemed to be essentially Lincoln doubling down on the Declaration of Independence. That speech, of course, is the Gettysburg Address. Our guest this hour is Ken Burns, and tomorrow night, PBS will be airing his latest documentary, The Address. It's a cinema verite style, a tiny boarding school in Vermont for boys with learning differences, and each year after Thanksgiving, they are challenged to memorize the Gettysburg Address and later to recite it in front of hundreds of people, and then they go to Gettysburg in May. And not only at this school, but Ken took on this national campaign to get everybody to learn the Gettysburg Address, and that was a campaign for last year. Well, it's a campaign for always, but last year was the 150th anniversary. Ken is with us this hour. He, you know about this man, except that when you look at all that he's done, you say, oh my gosh, what a body of work. He is a really celebrated documentarian, and he has been called by so many a really fine documentarian, the best perhaps who ever lived. The Baltimore Sun said of him, he's not only the greatest of the day, but also the most influential filmmaker, period. The late historian Stephen Ambrose said of his films, more Americans get their history from Ken Burns than any other source. He has won all kinds of Emmys and Oscar nominations. I understand he's working on a documentary now on the Roosevelts, which should air sometime this fall. He's also working on one on Jackie Robinson, and he did the baseball and the Civil War, and we'll tell you more about all that he's done during the course of this hour. But this hour, Abraham Lincoln and the Gettysburg Address. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Ken Burns. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Hi, Ken Burns. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you, Kathleen, for having me.
Yeah,
it's my privilege.
Our great pleasure. I love the story. What a Christmas present this must have been when your daughter, you have four daughters, recited the Gettysburg Address for you on Christmas morning.
I was a single dad. At that point, I had two daughters. One was 12 and one was 8. And I was trying to figure out how to buy all the things that little girls wanted that would make the Christmas happy and joyous in tough times. And I looked around and I could see my youngest, there was something wrong. And I thought, oh no, I've screwed up. And she said, Dada, Sarah has one more. And I said, one more what? She was present. And Sarah stood up in her nightgown and in that early morning Christmas light that we all know around the tree recited flawlessly the Gettysburg Address. Now this little girl has gone on to give me my grandchild, so I can't say it's her greatest gift to me, but she's given me the greatest Christmas present I've ever had, and tears were coursing down my cheeks, and then it would only be, not that long afterwards that the Greenwood School in Putney, Vermont, across the river from us in New Hampshire, invited me to be a judge 10 years ago at one of these galas where they have the public recitations. And I once again wept like a baby and kept coming back thinking someone else will do this film. It's not my style. It would be, as you said, cinema verite, and I'm used to a different kind of classical historical form of explication. And finally, I just realized, what are you waiting for? Just go and do it. And so we did it. And it was such a present. I had to convince our underwriters, Bank of America and PBS and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the Better Angel Society to please let us shoehorn in another. I'm working on six other films. And they're going, Ken, how can you possibly do another one and one that's going to come out first before all those others? But I have to do it. And I think that part of this thing is a tail that might be wagging the dog in a good way, and that is this educational challenge, the idea of reaching out to all Americans and ask them to recite or to memorize and then to upload at learntheaddress.org. And we've gotten all the five living presidents.
I know you have. Yeah.
But more important, we have thousands of our fellow citizens who, from, you know, school kids in Alabama and Utah and Hawaii to 90-year-old ladies to a father and daughter who memorized it together and then recited it together after they drove to Gettysburg and set up their camera, and they've uploaded it. The Mayo Clinic has uploaded not just the doctors and surgeons, but the nurses and the workers.
Oh,
there,
really?
All contributing. So has most of the ESPN anchors. The U.S. men's soccer team has done a mashup. It's just caught fire. And I would urge any person within the sound of my voice, including you, Kathleen, to take me up on it. You'll curse me for a couple days.
Okay.
But then you'll get it, and then you'll thank me for the rest of your life. It will permanently be on your hard drive, and you will know the Gettysburg Address, and it's only 2 minutes.
Well, we'll thank you for the rest of our lives for everything else you've given us, too. So that just can add to the list. Definitely. And we should get the Milwaukee Brewers to do that, too. They're on a roll here, huh?
They came to take care of my Red Sox at the beginning of the season.
Hey, all right. Well, we'll ask them to do that as well. I must tell you, I absolutely adore Abraham Lincoln, and finally had a chance to go to Gettysburg with a group of listeners 2 years ago now, and I wept like a baby when I stood at the spot where Abraham Lincoln delivered that address to. There is the whole era, the magnificence of the man and the power of the words. As you say, they are poetry. They're just so carefully chosen, so incredibly important. And here you are getting thousands and thousands of people to memorize it all these years later.
Yeah, you know, Abraham Lincoln has a special place in my heart, as in yours. I think he's our best president. He is remarkable. It was said of Theodore Roosevelt, who we've just finished a big series on, it'll be out in September. It was said that he had distance in his eyes. But I actually think it's Abraham Lincoln who had distance in his eyes. You think about this short address. The first sentence, 47 years ago, is about the past. The second sentence, now we are engaged in a great civil war, is about the present. But the rest of it is Lincoln pulling us into a hopeful future, a democratic future where we really do believe that all men are created equal. He's not only doubling down on the Declaration, he's giving us a Declaration of Independence 2.0, an operating system that we still use today.
Mm-hmm.
That's the source of your tears. Your tears are not a sentimentality or nostalgia. They're of the higher emotions our founders, including Thomas Jefferson, thought would eventually be unleashed by a people governing themselves.
Right.
And I think what Lincoln did, coming in the next second or third generation, was to finally give full voice to what our potential was, what we could be as a nation. And you find it in his first inaugural when he talks about the better angels of our nature, the name of the nonprofit that's helping us, or the mystic chords of memory. You hear it in his address to Congress in 62, fellow citizens, we cannot escape history. The fiery trial through which we pass will light us down in honor or dishonor to the latest generation. You hear it in the second inaugural, both in its Old Testament fury about blood drawn from the lash, meaning slavery, and the blood drawn from the sword and his willingness to keep going for hundreds of years, if necessary, to free Americans, and then turns around in the next sentence and says, with malice towards none, with charity for all, an Old Testament kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But particularly in this Gettysburg Address, are we fully vested with the great beauty of Lincoln's prose? But it doesn't stop there at just a great piece of writing, political writing, emotional poetry, whatever you might call it. It has to do with the centrality of these words in our system. When the first anniversary of 9/11 happened in New York City, they read the list of the desperately sad list of the names of the dead. But then they also read Abraham Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. It had nothing to do with 9/11, absolutely nothing. But it was as if those words could remind us again why we agreed to cohere. They could also be a kind of glue that would bind up the division. And it would also be medicine that would heal the wounds. And these boys at the little Greenwood School know what it means when Lincoln says a new birth of freedom. They accepted the challenge. They brought the hope to the equation. They met the difficulty, and they did what Lincoln had asked of them, and they have something they'll carry around for the rest of their lives.
And it's really amazing to watch them, because this is a difficult thing for many of these young people to do, either getting the words out correctly or the order of the words, because there are problems that they're facing with their speech or the way the letters are organized in their mind. So this is very careful, very deliberate. And then at the end, to see them succeed and be able to deliver this masterpiece with hundreds of people watching them, you must have cried through the whole ceremony. It's a huge accomplishment.
It is an unbelievable accomplishment. And remember, each of the kids, they range in age from 11, very young, to 17. They've been bullied and marginalized at other schools. This is a place of last resort for them. But the teachers there have also said, what are you good at? What can we feed? What part of you can we feed that you're good at? And they've come with a variety of, you know, dyslexia, ADHD, dysgraphia, executive functional, a whole host of learning differences. So some kids can memorize it right away, but they've got certain speech impediments or defects or processing things that make it so hard to express that memorization. Some memorization is the hardest task of all. But all of them, by the end, sort of get a mastery in their own way. They wholly reflect themselves, but they've also imbibed of it. And it just belies this notion of rote memorization as being something foolish. I suppose if you're memorizing it for the sake of it, it is. But I don't see any of those boys who do that. They do it as a possibility of liberation. And they're using a part of their brain that we all ought to be using. My dad, who was born in 1925, had maybe 5 or 6 hours on his
hard
drive.
Whoa, good for him. Wow.
You know, long stretches of Shakespeare, great poetry, you know, all that sort of stuff. I've got maybe a couple of hours. I don't know, maybe not that much. And we just don't teach anything. Everybody doesn't have to remember anything anymore. And I don't like that. I think civics and memorization and singing songs, shared songs together. We like to do things in unison. That's the way we'll repair our educational system. That's how we'll repair this lack of civil discourse in our country, is reminding people of the glories of our past, not by tearing everything down, by describing how the person is other. The historian Arthur Schlesinger Jr., now deceased, said in the late 80s or early 90s, there's too much pluribus and not enough unum, referring to the Latin motto of the United States. And I realized when I heard him say that I'd been in the unum business all my life. Mm-hmm. And I think kids are very much about that. And I think this initiative at LearnTheAddress.org is that too. So yeah. I hope that everybody tries to memorize it.
All right. Well, you've challenged us. Who is worth memorizing? Who have you chosen to memorize?
What do you mean?
When you talk about you have an hour or so in your head, your dad had six.
It's probably mostly Lincoln, but it's a lot of things from the films I've worked on. I've got a couple of verses of Edgar Allan Poe's The Raven and a couple of other Poe poems that I had in school, that sort of thing, limericks that can't be recited on National Public Radio, just like my dad. I got them from my dad. And you know, most of it, it's stuff I picked up from being in the editing room and hearing things over and over again. And they're imprinting. If you wanted me to just sort of begin to spout my first film on the Brooklyn Bridge right now, I will. But I don't think you have time. You know, that's sort of what it is. But I think it would be great if, you know, my daughter, I've got four daughters. I've now got, you know, two grown ones and two little ones. One's three and one's nine. And my nine-year-old has, last year at school, also in Vermont, memorized all of The Midnight Ride of Paul Revere. She was only supposed to memorize eight lines, but she just picked up the whole thing and she said, Daddy, I think I can do it. And I said, well, you should do it. And then I reminded her this year she did it. She goes, no, I only knew eight lines. I said, try. And she had it. And, you know, I'm fairly confident, having heard the story of her big, big sister, Sarah, that one of these days she's going to walk up to me and I'm going to put the paper down and or it's going to be Christmas morning and Olivia Burns is going to recite the Gettysburg Address to her, you know, equally, you know, you know, melting in a puddle of tears, Father.
Right. Ken Burns is our guest this hour, and we're welcoming phone calls for him. We can go in a lot of directions. His documentary, his latest, The Address, will be on tomorrow night on PBS about a group of boys, 11 to 17, with learning differences who, after Thanksgiving vacation, they learn the Gettysburg Address. They recite it, memorize it, and eventually they go to Gettysburg, and we have to talk about being at Gettysburg. Ken knows those grounds very well. He, of course, has directed and produced some of the most celebrated and really highest-rated documentaries in TV history. The Civil War, the landmark PBS series, attracted an audience of 40 million during its premiere run in 1990. He also had an 8-part series on the West, 10-part episode on jazz, 7-part on the war, a look at World War II through the prism of 4 American towns. The National Parks, America's Best Idea. He's won all kinds of Emmys. His next documentary is The Roosevelt Family, an intimate history, a 7-episode series. He also has films on Jackie Robinson, the Vietnam War, and the history of country music, all in the works. On this day, where we mark the 149th anniversary of the assassination of President Abraham Lincoln, we're talking about the Gettysburg Address and also Ken's huge project, which has people all over the country reciting the Gettysburg Address, learntheaddress.org. So join our conversation, if you would like, on Abraham Lincoln, his importance, his assassination, which took place today, the Gettysburg Address, the importance of memorizing important poetry and landmark works that have been significant in our nation's history. What do you think of that idea? Ken's work on the Civil War, on baseball, on whatever. Our lines are open for you, for him. And here's how you reach us. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're also on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. And don't worry, we will hear some very prominent Americans reading the Gettysburg Address. That'll be coming up in a few minutes. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, our phone number for Ken Burns, 800-486-8655. Again, his latest documentary, which is a different kind of one, it's a cinema verite, will be on tomorrow night, The Address on PBS. Nancy in Milwaukee is our first caller, Ken. Hi, Nancy.
Hello. I'm wondering if Ken knows the story of the young man named Rathbone and the young lady that he was with seated in the same area as Lincoln was the night he was assassinated. This man actually received, I believe, a knife slash from Booth and actually tried to intervene in this whole episode. And evidently that episode so deranged him that later, many, many years later, he had already married the young woman he was with that night in this little seating area. And much, much later, he had married that woman, and he ended up murdering her.
Oh, my goodness. I don't know that story. Do you, Ken?
Well, I did know that originally Grant was going to accompany the president to the theater and sit in the presidential box at Ford's Theater. And at the last moment, he was called away, I believe, to Philadelphia. And Major Rathbone and his fiancée did go. I didn't know about that subsequent history.
No.
of unhingement. Nancy, how kind of you to fill us in on the reverberating tragedy of the loss of our greatest president.
Mm-hmm. That's the other part of this history. I mean, to hold the country together during this incredibly difficult, horrendous time, brothers killing brothers and the North against the South, it's hard to imagine it, even though it wasn't all that long ago. And then another tragedy, the man who has been able to accomplish that, to be assassinated, you know, it just sort of takes your breath away.
Well, Shelby Foote, when we were working on the editing of the film and struggling with the very complex narrative, as you can imagine, called me up and just said, remember, God is the greatest dramatist. You know, and here's somebody who finds out on the 9th that he's won the war, that the opposing general, Robert E. Lee, has surrendered, and 5 days later sort of feels like, wow, I can exhale and go to the theater. And he doesn't make it. Yeah. From there, it's the bittersweet aspect of this whole life. And yet, as his great rival and later friend, the Secretary of War, Edwin Stanton, said as they closed his eyes early in the morning, just after 7 o'clock on the 15th, in the boarding house across the street, now he belongs to the ages. And I think that's what we're talking about right now, Kathleen and Nancy, that Lincoln has somehow achieved a kind of immortality few mortals have ever achieved, because in part the irony of being cut short, I suppose, in the way Jack Kennedy, but I think more in the sense of his just sheer greatness as a human being and his being able to contain the contradictions and understand where we were going as a people.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Nancy, for your call. Ron in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi there. Yes, I'm a documentary filmmaker, and I just simply admire the great contribution you're making to the world. And I want to know, in your experience and thoughts, whether you think that documentary and filmmaking and the television and the internet are the greatest educational tools the world has ever known, and how can we speed up? Or is it speeding up the education of the general population?
It's a great question, Ron. I think that as in almost all things in life, there's two sides to it. It is, of course, potentially the most powerful tool there is, and maybe no longer potentially, maybe it is. But it's not without its pernicious aspects. It's not without its things to be careful of. It's turned us into individual free agents rather than groups of people hewing to philosophies or beliefs or religions or, you know, family blood or things like that. It used to be when I was growing up that it was 2.1 people were watching a television set at any time. Now it's one, you know, because it's mostly us on our individual devices. And that creates a kind of loneliness. As much as it connects, there is an essential, profound, almost existential loneliness that comes along with it. So we have to be careful that we also don't, in our surfing, continue to erode our precious but easily squandered attention. We all know that all real meaning accrues in duration, that the work any one of us is proudest of, the relationships we care the most about, have benefited from our sustained attention. But now we have instruments before us that encourage us to skip like a frenetic butterfly or hummingbird from one site to another. And something's lost there. And I think the ability to stop, to turn these devices over, to use a book, I still think the greatest mechanical invention human beings have made, to look at a face, to connect with the other, is the best thing that we can do. And we know this from our faith, from our art, from our reason, from our literature, from our science, from our family. And yet a good deal of what that great and powerful, potentially powerful thing does is isolate us further from it. I'm in Manhattan today, and I just walked down a block, and I was the only person, and I'm guilty of it too. I don't mean to say I'm immune to it. I was the only person at that block that would not have my face buried a smartphone. And it just sort of struck me. I mean, it's different than being on a train car where everybody's reading a newspaper, because it's just different. And I hope that what's lost in that can be regained or at least offset by the greatness of it. We need to use the internet as tools to education, but I think it's going to be the glue that holds the things together. are going to be basic things like bringing civics back into school, mm-hmm. which is really about, it sounds like homework, but it's also about politics, small p politics, which is also the glue. It's how things work. It's like the owner's manual. And when we got rid of that, we disconnected our education from ourselves. And so we thought, oh, we're not doing enough science, enough STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Let's do that. But then we threw the baby out with the bathwater, getting rid of the humanities and history and philosophy and art and music. And, well, just put that back in, forgetting that right in front of us all along was the key, which is civics, an awareness of how things work, not just how government works, but how things work. So it's very easy now to criticize government. But most of that criticism is going from people who, A, depend on it in a ways they're unaware of, and also don't know enough about it to even be in a discussion about criticizing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you have said that you do films. This is kind of an interesting way to get at this, spending time on an issue, that you do films about subjects that they're worth studying, but that you want to know something more about. And you don't just do, you know, a 10-minute thing, a blurb about this. You do this massive Civil War documentary or baseball or so many different issues that we need to, in order to understand something, we do need to immerse ourselves in it. There's a whole lot to learn about so many subjects that you may as well take your time with those that are important, that you deem are worth knowing about, right? And that takes time.
It does take time, and that's something which we don't often spend these days. Everything has to be quick, 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 quick.
Right.
And yet the stuff that we like is the stuff that doesn't come quick. So it's a very complicated dichotomy, and we have to be very careful. But yeah, I mean, if you want to make a film and tell people what they ought to know about something, that's homework, you know. but if you don't know something about a subject, you want to know about it, and you invest yourself, and then it's like, hey, let me tell you what I learned. That's sharing with an audience a process of discovery, which only magnifies the quality of the storytelling, and that's what gets people engaged. I think that's the key to the success of all these films and the tens of millions of people who watch them, is not that I'm some, you know, guru of history. It's just that I have a story, and they're interested in finding out what I learned so that they learn it. And people just write me all the time and said, I had no idea. And
that's,
I love that.
I had no idea. Now I do. That's good. Let's go. Thank you, Ron, so much for your call. Ken Burns is our guest this hour, and we have lines open if you've been trying to get through. There are two right now. So the number is 800-486-8655. Mona in Madison is next. Hello, Mona.
Hello, and hello, Ken. I'm a retired school teacher. I taught elementary school and remedial reading, and I am so happy that you are reinforcing the importance of memorization and recitation. I would just like to start off with something that comes from my depths of my memory. I never saw a purple cow. I never hoped to see one, but I can tell you anyhow, I'd rather see than be one. I learned that when I was probably about 8 years old.
I remember that too.
And it just popped into my head as you were talking.
Is that
what I had for breakfast today, but I'll tell you that stuck with me. When I taught school, when I was in school, of course, we memorized lots of things, the Village Smithy and Casey at the Bat, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. When I taught my very first year out, I was teaching second grade, and I had my second graders memorize the night before Christmas, and each child had a stanza. I assigned them alphabetically, and so my student named Joe Foreman was near the end of the story, and he got the line, and away they all flew like down on a thistle, and poor little Joe had a lisp. But I'll tell you, he got that after practice, and we went around to all the other classrooms, and we cited it. And it gives children a sense of accomplishment, and it also preserves part of our national fabric.
Mm.
And I just think that is just so important. And so kudos to you for bringing recitation and memorization back to the forefront of the American conscious.
Wow, Mona, we really need you for our publicity campaign here. We've got a little bit more than 24 hours to go before the broadcast tomorrow night on PBS. But you nailed it very simply about stitching that fabric back together, and also that great sense of satisfaction at the accomplishment. That's all part of it. And the fact that it's the Gettysburg Address, that's the icing on the cake.
Right. There's also a real tribute in the address, tomorrow night's film, to loving, caring teachers. The footage on the teachers is so good. I mean, they're so good, aren't they?
It's, you know, I'm so glad you said that. I mean, you want to take your hat off to the parents who've had the great extra anxiety, not just of parenthood, period, but of parenthood with kids who have these learning difficulties and all of the stuff they've had to go through and the worries and the anxieties. But when you look at, as you say, the sort of loving nature of the teachers and the staff and the administration at the Greenwood School, you see how lucky these boys are. They really is, love is the sort of the final thing that they do, and they just nurture them and give them something else. You know, they come in there distraught, upset, as you see in the film. There are very tense moments and very anxious moments and sad moments. But somehow along the way, with patience and forbearance and great love, these kids can master this, and that's pretty great.
It is great. Steele in Appleton is next. Hi, Steele.
Yes. Thank you, Ken Burns, that you encourage your children and audience to know great words of men. And Martin Luther King, everyone knows, I Have a Dream. But about 3 years ago, well, my father ended up MIA, but he did two tours, and then he was KIA. But one of the I cried, I learned about it 3 years ago, Martin Luther King's speech, A Time to Break Silence. And I'm just going to read the first sentence. Even when pressed by the demands of inner truth, men do not easily assume the task of opposing their government's policy, especially in time of war. Anyway, thank you so much.
What a wonderful passage! What a great reminder! When you make a claim, and Americans, and I'm no exception, like to say the best or the worst or the most or the least about Lincoln or the Gettysburg Address, you immediately have to sort of means test it and sort of think about the other speeches that qualify. Franklin Roosevelt gave a few. Ronald Reagan gave one. I can think on the Challenger disaster. Martin Luther King certainly has given a number of speeches that qualify among the great American rhetorical speeches, and it's good to be reminded he rarely wrote a bad sentence.
Yeah, and President Obama's speech on race, I thought, was a beautiful speech,
yes.
Wasn't it?
Really great. He's given a number that I think have captured the dynamism, or what did he call it, the fierce urgency of now. Mm-hmm. I think he was quoting Dr. King.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Take the young boys from the school with us, please, to Gettysburg. Well, it must have been quite something for them after they spent all this time and they mastered the delivery to actually be at the battlefield.
Well, here I was going to say that something you said in the first part of the show, which is they'd never been to Gettysburg before.
Right.
And when I learned that, I said, we've got to change that. And so we rented a bus, and we rented motel rooms for two nights for the entire school, and we drove down there, and I gave a day-long tour of the battlefield that ended up at the cemetery where Lincoln delivered the speech, and it was just a magical day, and this occurred 3 months after the gala. After the gala, they just dropped the Gettysburg Address and returned to other studies and the studies that were ongoing, et cetera, et cetera. But as the day progressed, we would peel off one kid at a time and have them recite the Gettysburg Address. And after 3 months of no practice or no urgency and no knowledge that we were going to do this, every single one of them had it still down cold. And it was just a revelation. And can I tell you, in 3 years they'll have it, and in 30 years they'll have it.
Yes,
and
they
will. Is a real exciting thing.
And they all shine in different ways, don't they?
Yes, that's right. And this is important. We are all different. And we are a country that likes to believe we celebrate individuality, but we don't. In fact, the individuality of these kids, they're not dumb. They just have different systems of learning than most of us do, whatever normal is. But these kids get bullied by other kids who can be mean. They present issues and problems for schools and school teachers. Even parents and siblings have a difficult time sometimes. And yet, as one parent says to the school therapist in the film. You know, I just want my kid to be normal. And his response is, it's not his job to be normal. We have to find a way to understand that for most of us, a language-based task like the Gettysburg Address, we just get on the interstate, and we just drive from point A to point B. We can do it. I tell you, as I said before, you can tape it up next to your mirror in the morning and curse me a few times as you go thinking, why did I do this? But when you do it, it'll be fine. These kids have to take a long and circuitous route. It doesn't mean they don't get there, and it doesn't mean that they're dumb. It means that they have to develop new strategies, new neural pathways to figure out how to get from point A to point B. Maybe it takes a little bit longer. But did you know, Kathleen, that there's a disproportionate number of CEOs of Fortune 500 companies who have dyslexia, which means they must have developed novel strategies, not just to overcome this learning difference or to shore up their abilities in that way, but I think to have, they're just able to persevere and basically become better at things than the rest of us who just sort of assume that we're normal and
yes.
This is how you learn and I'll raise my hand, I know this, and good boy, Ken, you get a good grade, whatever it is. And I love that. I love that.
Ken Burns, our guest this hour, his latest documentary, which is on the Address, and you know when we say the Address, it's Gettysburg, is going to be on PBS tomorrow night, and it's a different kind of film for him. It's cinema verite, and it centers on this boarding school, young boys, 11 to 17, who they have some problems in various learning areas, and they memorize the Gettysburg Address and then present it. And it's a task. It's really dissecting this speech so that it is poetry and it's very important. Every word is important in understanding how to say the word and what the meaning of the word is. And then to present this in front of hundreds of people. And then several months after they presented this, usually it's done around Lincoln's birthday, Ken took the school kids to Gettysburg where they saw the battlefield and then gave the Gettysburg Address again. All right, let's welcome more phone calls. We have some more minutes to do that. Here's the number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. We talked about the Brewers sending in the Gettysburg Address. Maybe some of you have done that already, or maybe there are other people in Wisconsin that he wants to make sure we can get a hold of those people for him and say, hey, got to sign up. Let's get it memorized. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Ken Burns is with us this hour, been making documentary films for 30 years, and his latest, The Address, premieres on PBS tomorrow, which marks the day 149 years ago that Abraham Lincoln died. Let's go back to phone calls. Laurel in Greendale, hi.
Hi. First of all, I'm so happy to have this opportunity to call in, and I'm not going to miss the program. I wanted to ask Ken Burns if he could tell us, I want to go back to that issue about civics and the whole history, that what was going on at the time of the address. I mean, our country was so divided at that time. And from what I recall from my own learning is that there were over 50,000 soldiers that were killed on the battlefield, and many of them were not allowed to be buried there at the time, mostly the Confederate soldiers. So this was not necessarily a happy time in the time of the country, and Lincoln was trying so hard to bring everyone together. And I think that his address says something, too, about his efforts as president to try and do that against, you know, all these terrible odds at the time.
That's a really, really good point that you make. I think this is what he was, his ability to be a great reconciler. It's why we miss and are so grieved by his absence in the period we now know as Reconstruction,
yes.
what kind of things Lincoln could have brought to bear. So let me just correct a couple of things. There were 10,000 dead from the battle. There were 56,000 casualties. And it's often the literary style of people writing about battles to sort of imply that casualties means death. Casualties means dead and wounded and missing. There were 56,000 casualties of the Battle of Gettysburg, 185,000 soldiers engaged at least, and a great deal of trauma and bloodshed. You know, there wasn't a house that wasn't turned into a hospital. There aren't families that still have books that lined with blood because they were pillows or petticoats that were stained at the bottom up a few inches because of the blood that covered the floors of houses. Not a very pretty picture. 750,000 Americans would die over the course of the entire Civil War. It was the worst and most important moment in the history of the United States. I don't know about people not being buried. There are Confederate dead in the cemetery at Gettysburg in a separate section. And I know that there was time for those to clear the wounded and the dead from the field after Pickett's charge was a failure and the Gettysburg campaign, at least from the South's perspective, was over and Lee would limp back down south, eventually to the Potomac, crossing back over into Virginia again. I'm sure there are instances of anger and displeasure where people might not have been buried, but I think the thing to carry away, as you did, Laurel, is just the sense of the president trying desperately to speak to his countrymen. You know, the United States never called this the Civil War. Their official title of it is the War of the Rebellion. They never recognized the Confederate States of America. They saw this as an insurrection that needed to be quelled. And that is quite a difference from those apologists of the cause of slavery who would like you to believe that this was a separate country. It acted at times like a separate country, but in point of fact, the United States government never recognized its existence. And Lincoln was behind that. It was his intention to call them rebels, and that's it, and to try to reunite the country. And he did so magnificently and generously, and no more so than in his sparkling words at Gettysburg.
Mm. Thanks, Laurel, so much for the call. Deborah in the UP, hi.
Hi, Ken. Oh, this is so great. I think you're so important to everybody in the country because you just put everything together so wonderfully for everyone to understand. And I loved your National Park show, and I was a little disappointed that the UP wasn't in there because we had the first National Park on Water in Munising, Michigan. But I wanted to ask you your opinion on war, because I find myself trying to analyze and figure it out. Why do we fight wars? Is it like in our DNA? So that's my question.
Why is there war, Ken? It's a big one.
It's a big one, and it's a good one. I first would like to say it's always a relief to me when people tell me that a long series, you know, that's 14 or 15 hours, we left something out. I feel really good about that. Nobody's saying it's boring. It's just we wish you'd done that, and we wish we had done, of course, the UP as well. I'm a Michigander, and I grew up in Ann Arbor. So I'm just postponing talking about war. I'd like to believe that we could evolve as a species. I don't believe that will be the case. I think that war will be with us always. I think it is easier for human beings to hate and want to fight the other than it is to understand them. That the great principles of all of our religious teachings, but particularly the Judeo-Christian teaching, have been ignored, and that has to do with the fact that all of us have a difficulty doing that. And then you've got situations like the Civil War. What do you do with 4 million Americans who are owned by other Americans? How long would you like to stay in slavery? A generation and a half, as many people said, slavery would have lasted. Nope, a decade, a year, a month, a week, a day, maybe an hour. I don't think anybody wants to experience what slaves experienced in the United States. Then you think about the Second World War and the Nazi and militarist threat from Germany and Japan. Someone in our series on World War II called it a necessary war. He said it so poignantly that we gave that as the title of our first episode. I wrestle with this all the time. I'd like to believe in the perfectibility. I do believe in the perfectibility of human beings, but I don't believe that within my lifetime we will see this, or in the lifetime of my great-grandchildren, we will ever see the end of war, unless one of those wars has ended us. It's just there's almost been, I think there was some historian, I think Will and Ariel Durant, that counted up the times when there was no wars going on in the history of the world, and it was like 17 years, but I bet you somewhere a conflict going on somewhere at some point, even during those 17 years, where blood was being shed instead of us putting into practice what we say we believe on Sunday.
Cecilia in Manitowoc sends an email. She shares our enthusiasm for Lincoln. She has a concern. Lincoln had many losses in his life. He must have known how difficult it is to survive losses. How could he send thousands of young men to death in just one battle? Has anyone ever written about what must have been an internal conflict?
Oh, very much so. And I think there's not a good biography of Lincoln that doesn't sort of try to deal with this. The melancholy that's in him, these bouts of depression, the sadness that he felt, the weight that he carried, all of that is part of the Lincoln legacy and Lincoln baggage, and has to be considered. You know, he said, this is my favorite president, he said one of the most chilling lines I have ever heard, Commander-in-Chief said, after the disaster of the Battle of Chancellorsville, yet another humiliating Union defeat at the hands of superior generalship by the South, but also inferior and incompetent generalship on the part of the North. He said, this war will be won when I can find the general who understands the arithmetic. And what he meant was that, and by the way, he found that general. His name was Ulysses S. Grant. He imported him from the West, meaning Tennessee, and brought him east to fight those battles. That, unlike the other Union generals who sort of suffered losses and retreated, that he would suffer losses and keep going. That he understood that the North had a numerical advantage, that it had a technological advantage, and that in the spring of 64, in the Wilderness and Spotsylvania and Cold Harbor, and then around Petersburg, there would be what was essentially a rehearsal for World War One and the great not only trench warfare, but also just the wholesale slaughter of human beings. When Lincoln, you know, saved the Gettysburg Address, there had already been hundreds of thousands of lives lost. But the sad thing was, even though this was clearly a turning point in the war, is that there were hundreds of thousands of more lives that were going to be lost. And that's the calculus, that's the arithmetic that Lincoln had to chillingly understand. So I think there is a great sadness on the part of a commander-in-chief at any time.
Yes.
This commander-in-chief right now, back to George Washington, on the fact that their orders, their actions will cause the lives of other people. And you have to remember that all our wars, from the Revolution, the War of 1812, the Mexican War, the Spanish-American War, World War One, World War Two, Korea, Vietnam, the Gulf Wars, and Afghanistan, have not equaled the total number of deaths in the Civil War, both North and
South. Yeah.
That's just a kind of hard thing to,
it is.
Put our heads around.
I know. Thank you for all you've done. We'll look forward to this tomorrow. We want to end with the Gettysburg Address. So thank you for being with us. Deeply appreciated.
It's my pleasure.
Thanks. Ken Burns. Go to learntheaddress.org and memorize it and put it on record. This is Many Americans, Famous Ones, and it's a compilation of little pieces of the Gettysburg Address from those famous Americans to end our show.
Four score and 7 years ago,
brought forth on this continent
a new nation conceived in liberty
and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal.
Now we are engaged in a great civil war,
testing whether that nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure.
We are met on a great battlefield of that war.
We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place
for those who here gave their lives that that nation might live.
It is altogether fitting and proper that we should do this.
But in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate.
We cannot consecrate.
We cannot hallow this ground.
The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here,
have consecrated it.
Far above our poor power to add or detract.
The world will little note nor long remember what we say here.
But it can never forget what they did here.
It is for us, the living, rather,
to be dedicated here to the unfinished work
which they who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced.
It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us.
That from these honored dead, we take increased devotion to that cause
for which they gave the last full measure of devotion.
That we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain.
That this nation, under God,
shall have a new birth of freedom.
And that government of the people,
by the people, for the people.